Good morning, everyone. Every once in a while, I end up speaking on a Sunday that falls exactly between the two birthdays of Buddha and Shankaracharya. And I'm always fascinated by the similarities and differences between the two, because they're both two fascinating figures, and they have so much in common. They were so important, so much in common, and yet in some ways they were so different. And they both had a tremendous influence, two of the most influential figures, the whole the history of Indian spirituality. And of course, that translates to the whole world, especially with Buddhism, how it traveled all throughout Asia and now throughout the world. So we had Shankaracharya's birthday last Wednesday, and Buddha's birthday will be next Sunday. In the case of the Buddha, not only his birthday, this is what they call the thrice blessed day. So he was born on that full moon day, we call the Buddha Purnima. Then he had his nirvana that same day, and then his parinirvana. Then he passed away out of the body on that same day. So it's called the thrice blessed day. So these are not only two of the most important figures, but they're intertwined. There's a very deep connection between the two of them. Of course, Buddha was much earlier, but the whole Buddhist tradition and Shankaracharya's Advaita Vedanta overlapped and clashed, of course, to a certain degree. But they were both great reformers. We have to remember in the case of Buddha that he came at a time when there was an excess of ritual and priestcraft and other aspects of society that needed some reform. And in the case of Shankaracharya, it was almost the society that had been practically converted to Buddhism that also needed reform. And two of them, if we look at the monastic tradition of India, we only find really two instances of fully organized monasticism, at least up until the time of Shankaracharya, and that was first with the Buddhist monks and nuns, and then later with Shankaracharya. Their philosophies, of course, were considered to be very different, and yet Shankaracharya, when they wanted to criticize him, they would say he was a hidden Buddhist. So we'll see poles apart, but similar in many ways. And there was a constant battle philosophically. The time of Shankaracharya, this was a period when many of the philosophical schools would have debates, and whoever would win, the other side would have to convert to their point of view. So this was a very transitional period. And Shankaracharya came in between this strong Buddhist period and the ascendant Hindu period, we can say. If Swamiji is right, and I won't question him, he says that at one point, within a few hundred years, practically the entire country was a Buddhist. We can say the influence of Buddha was so strong. So we see these two great figures. Shankara was the upholder of orthodoxy. He really reestablished a lot of the old Vedic traditions and traditional Hinduism. And he did this in several ways. One was in a very philosophical way through all of his different writings. He wrote commentaries on the Upanishad, the Gita, and Brahma Sutra. This is known as the Prasthanatraya. And because of this, it became incumbent on any philosophical tradition to have commentaries on these three if they wanted to be taken seriously. So almost everything that Shankaracharya did, he set a precedent. He did it once, then everyone else had to do it. And his commentaries were so important that the Upanishads that he wrote commentaries on are considered the major Upanishads. And his commentary on the Gita was raised it to such a level that some people during one period actually thought that Shankaracharya himself composed the Gita. Yeah. So it just shows what a tremendous influence he had. No one else at that time had that tremendous power that he had. Buddha, on the other hand, was not only not orthodox, he was a real iconoclast. He didn't care about the scriptures, he didn't care about Sanskrit. The real reason why Buddhism was considered heterodox, why it was outside of the pale of the Vedic tradition, was that he didn't accept the authority of the Vedas. It wasn't so much that his philosophy was so different, because when we look at all the different viewpoints and philosophies within Vedanta, within the whole tradition, this easily could fit in as one of them. But there was that one sticking point, unless there was at least some nominal recognition that of the authority of the Vedas, they would have to be considered a heterodox type of school. So we see that one is the ultimate philosopher, Shankaracharya. Buddha, on the other hand, was almost an anti-philosopher. He would simply keep quiet most of the time when he was asked on his position of, we know all of these things. What is there a real self? Does God exist? He would remain silent. He didn't like to go into these things, although we find that he also had a brilliant mind. So this distinction that Shankaracharya had this brilliant mind and no heart, and Buddha had a great heart and no mind, is a little bit overblown. Because Shankaracharya also had his compassion, we'll see that, and Buddha also had his brilliance. Anyhow, Swamiji himself felt that the combination of these two was the greatest combination and what was needed in the ideal character, in the formation of an ideal character. So he said, what is now wanted is the combination of the greatest heart with the highest intellectuality, of infinite love with infinite knowledge. Existence without knowledge and love cannot be. Knowledge without love and love without knowledge cannot be. What we want is the harmony of existence, knowledge, and bliss infinite, for that is our goal. We want harmony, not one-sided development, and it is possible to have the intellect of a Shankara with the heart of a Buddha. I hope we shall all struggle to attain that blessed combination. And of course, the irony is that Swamiji is really describing himself, right? Because he embodied both that brilliant intellect of Shankaracharya and that tremendously compassionate heart of Buddha. So I want to speak about these two a little bit side by side this morning and perhaps spend a little more time on the similarities than the differences, because in the final analysis, they were not so different at all. They both came out of great compassion, and their teachings were done only for the welfare of others. Shankaracharya, he could have remained alone meditating in a cave his whole life. It wouldn't have mattered to him. Buddha also, after his nirvana. So it was really out of compassion that after their great experiences, realizations, enlightenments, nirvana, that they came back to teach and help reform society to a certain extent. So we see philosophical differences, but in the practical teachings, the great emphasis that they both placed on intensity and dispassion in spiritual life are identical. On this one-pointed devotion to the ideal, we see it in both of them, and this willingness to sacrifice one's personal welfare for the welfare of the good, welfare of the many. This is something that is common to both of them. So I want to try to show that there's a value to the teachings of both of them that transcends all these philosophical niceties. We spend too much time sometimes with these questions. Is the world unreal? Is the world real? What does that mean to us, really? We don't know these things. But this great emphasis on going deep within and having some direct realization of the truth. We find that is the ultimate teaching with both of them, that realization is beyond the ability of the mind to think, and that through the heart we can get this highest type of nirvana. When we look at the main scriptures and teachings and writings and things, if we read this Dhammapada, the sayings of Buddha, we see it's such a beautiful book full of love and compassion and everything. And with Shankaracharya, rather than go to his philosophical works, if we go to some of his poetry, We recently had a retreat. I spent one session on the Bhajagovindam. I love this Bhajagovindam. We see it's not so much a philosophical treatise, but meant to lead us to a tremendous feeling of dispassion. Dispassion and longing for some higher type of truth and realization. Let me start with just a little bit of the life of Buddha. I don't want to go through the whole thing. Most of us have heard these stories many times, but I want to go through the pivotal events that took place before his great renunciation. We know he was born in a small kingdom. It wasn't a great big kingdom, but it was a little kingdom, and was born into great luxury. His father and mother, when he was born, they had his horoscope done for him, and they were told that either he will become a great spiritual leader, he'll renounce everything, become a great monk, or he'll be a great king and everything. So they were nervous because they didn't like this idea that, of course, he would leave, that he would renounce the world and everything. So they determined that he should have no experiences which would turn his mind inward, which would lead to any type of dissatisfaction with the world, that everything would be enjoyment and pleasure. So they had a great palace built for him, and he had the best food and entertainment, enjoyment, so every type of pleasure that you can imagine they had arranged for him. When he was old enough to get married, they arranged a marriage between him and a beautiful young cousin named Yashodhara, 16 years old, and they had, again, this life of perfect luxury. They had their own separate palace and everything, and orders were given to the workers at the palace that he shouldn't be allowed to go out and see the world, because as soon as he stepped out of the palace, he would be in the midst of everything, poverty and whatever we find in society today. But he had his charioteer that he was very close with, and he persuaded him, let's go out, let's go and look around and see what we can see. So the charioteer drove him out there, and the first day when they were going, he saw an old man bend over, just tottering on his stick, hardly able to walk, and he had never seen anything like that. He wasn't allowed to see anything like that. So we can, it's hard to imagine someone reaching the age of 16 or 18, whatever he was, or 20, whatever he was, never having seen an old person, not knowing that people age that way. But this was the condition, so he was surprised. So he said, who is this man, toothless, with white hair, all skin and bones, hardly able to walk? And his charioteer said, he is an old man, sire, weak and helpless, abandoned by his family, as birds leave a withered tree. And then this young Buddha, he said, how did it happen? So he thought this was just some once-in-a-lifetime thing that he happened to run across, some aberration. And this charioteer said, no, this is the law of nature. It happens to everyone. It will happen to your mother. It will happen to your father. It will happen to your beautiful young wife. And it will happen to you also. So the Buddha, his name was Siddhartha at that time. Siddhartha literally means one who has attained the goal. So the name itself presages what will happen in his life. Anyhow, he became very upset and a little angry. He said, take me back. And then he stewed a little bit. He brooded over this and thought about this. And then he said, let's go out again. So they had a second trip out. And this time he saw a sick man lying on the ground, groaning in pain. And again he said, who is he? What happened to him? And the charioteer said, he is a sick man, sire. There is no hope for him. He will die soon. And that same question, does it happen to everyone? And the charioteer said, yes, sire, sooner or later, something or other will happen. No one can escape it. This is the law of nature. These things happen. So again, very upset, he said, take me back. So he stayed for a while. Again, some days or some weeks, and then he said, let's go out again. And they went out, they saw a long line of people walking, weeping and crying, and they saw the four men holding a cot, and some figure is lying on it. And he said, "What is this?" And his charioteer said, "Sire, this is a dead man. They're taking him to the cremation ground. His body will be burnt. These are all his relatives and friends. They're weeping because this man has died." And then the Buddha said, "Well, is this the end for everyone?" And he said, "Yes. This is the end for everyone. There's no escaping this, that everyone will die one day. The body will be burnt. The relatives will come. The relatives will cry. And there's nothing that anyone can do about it." So this young Siddhartha, he thought, so this is what's meant by life. We think it's such a wonderful thing, singing and dancing in the palace and wonderful food and all of that. But no, this is life. Youth gives way to old age. Health gives way to disease. Life gives way to death. And people take pleasure in such a thing. So his mind was starting to completely change. So he went back, and thinking deeply about all of these things, he said, "Let's go out one more time." So this is the fourth trip. They went out, and when they were there, he sees a young man, handsome young monk, not looking around, eyes cast down, wearing ochre robes, looking very calm and very peaceful. And as Buddha said, "Who is this man wearing the beautiful ochre robes? So peaceful, so free, so fearless, so joyful." And his charioteer said, "He is a wandering mendicant, sire, with no possessions, with no desires, with no cares." And then Siddhartha said, "Good, he is an intelligent man. He's figured it out. He is a wise man. I would like to be such a man." So this we see that no matter how protected someone is, if the mind is ripe, just the vision of a few things can change everything. So he went back. Now, just as he went back to the palace with his mind in turmoil, but half decided what he has to do, he found that a child had been born. So he goes back. His wife is there. There's a newborn child. And he saw the child and he said, "Rahu jato bandhanam jatam." That a Rahu is born, a fetter has come to me, bondage has come to me. And he named the boy Rahula, meaning a fetter or an impediment, and knowing that this could conceivably be that ultimate bondage for him. So this is what he said: "Let him be named Rahula, for today an obstacle has been born to me." Now, because of the birth, there was great celebration. Everyone is singing and dancing and overeating and overdrinking and people falling on the ground and all sorts of things going on. And to Siddhartha, it was like a living hell. His mind had changed so much. So he saw these beautiful dancing girls. They looked like demons to him. The food and drink, it was like poison to him. And all the luxuries, these were like torture to him. So that once that Vairagya comes, that real renunciation comes, then it's unbearable to see these things. So he went to the bedroom. He gazed at his young wife with a newborn baby. Imagine this spirit of renunciation. And silently walked out. He went to the stable. He took one of the horses and he left the kingdom. Ultimately, he gave up his horse. He found a beggar, and he gave his princely clothes to the beggar and took on the rags of the beggar. And then we know he went with so many different groups, led such an austere life in search of truth, so austere that you could see his backbone from the front, they say. He would eat the equivalent of a mustard seed each day. So he was with a very austere group at one time. And then we know the story of the Sujata. He was practically starving to death, and she gave some pious for him, some rice pudding, and he ate that rice pudding, and that revived him. And then he took that great vow, "Ihasane shushudu me shiriram," let this body wither away. I won't move until I have that enlightenment. And then the whole night he spent like that, facing all the demons from the mind and all the desires and everything, and defeated them all. And in the morning he was transformed into Buddha. And then from there thought, shall I keep this great treasure to myself, or shall I tell the world about it? And that began his preaching. But he also went back to the kingdom and initiated the wife, the child, they all became part of this whole great new movement, which we know today as Buddhism. Now, life of Shankaracharya, equally fascinating. He also had these tremendous samskaras. He was born with these, especially monastic tendencies. He was born in a very small town in Kerala called Kaladi. Has anyone been there? Twice. I've been there once. Anyhow, we have a small center. The Ramakrishna Mission has a center there. We run a school and everything. Now they've built something new here, but when I was there, no big temple or anything. I thought it would be such an important place. But anyhow, this is where he was born. There's so many stories about when he was young and how the whole river had to move to come near their house. A lot of nice stories. Of course, the most famous one, before he was born, it's similar to Swamiji's mother, right, who prayed for a son, prayed to Lord Shiva, and had her sister go to the temple, Videshwar temple in Banaras, so that Swamiji was born. She also prayed to Lord Shiva that she would have a son. And Shiva appeared to her in a dream and said, okay, you have two options. Either you can have one ordinary son who would live a good life, be a good person and everything, or you can have a very special, brilliant son, but he won't live very long. So she opted for the brilliant one. So this is how Shankaracharya was born. And when he was very young, his father died. And we've seen this again also in the life of many great souls, Sri Ramakrishna and Swamiji, Chaitanya Deva, is a common theme. Partly because generally the husbands were much older than the wives in those days also. But the other reason, of course, is that even at a young age, it gives some sense of dispassion, renunciation, just as when Buddha saw the dead man for the first time. So this Shankaracharya, as a very young boy, was very brilliant. We know in those days the different type of education where they would learn scriptures from almost the time that they could speak. They would start memorizing, hearing these things and memorizing everything and learning everything. But he also developed this intense renunciation. As a very young boy, he wanted to renounce the world. But now, what is it? He only has mother is there. Father's no longer there. There won't be any more sons, so he'll be the one responsible for everything. So, and he wouldn't do it without the consent of his mother. And his mother said, no, my child, what will become of me? So one day he went for his bath, and you can see the bathing god is there, where the river is there. And he went for his bath, and there was a crocodile there. And this crocodile caught hold of him. So he's yelling and screaming, and his mother came and saw. And it looked like there's no way that he'll survive. This crocodile will gobble him up, and that'll be the end of the whole thing. So then he said, mother, no chance of my survival. Give your permission now, and I'll tell you what's called the apad sannyasa. In the time of danger, some of the rules are broken. You can do things right away. Apad dharma. When you're allowed to tell little lies sometimes, if there's under dire circumstances. So the mother thought, yes, and there's no chance of his salvation. Let him die as a sannyasi. That'll be a very auspicious type of death. And his next birth will be very fortunate for him. So she gave permission, and he took vows then and there. And, of course, the whole thing was a lila. So as soon as he did that, then the crocodile went away. Right? So then what could be done? Now even the mother knew that once you take vows, you can't give up those vows. So at that very young age, he took to this life of a wandering monk. But he told his mother, don't worry, that I'll come back when you're on your deathbed at least. I'll be there to be with you, and I'll do all the funeral rites and everything. Very unorthodox. For such an upholder of orthodoxy, he did something which was very much frowned upon. Sannyasis aren't supposed to have anything to do with the family or especially with the funeral rites and any Vedic rites, something like that. So we see that he wasn't, this such a unfeeling, strict upholder of orthodoxy in a case such as this with his mother. And again, in the life of Chaitanya Deva, we see the same thing. He wouldn't take sannyasa without his mother's approval. And she had lost so many sons, and the only other remaining son had also become a sannyasin. So he promised her, whenever you want to see me, I'll come. Sometimes in vision, maybe, like that. But anyhow, so he got her approval. So we see the very funny thing, such a strict separation from the family when traditionally when one takes the sannyasa. But in the case of Chaitanya Deva, the case of Buddha, the case of Shankaracharya, the case of Swamiji, how attached he was to his mother, the case of Sri Ramakrishna, kept his mother with him and served her to the very end, that we find this special devotion to the mother. There's a very nice book by Swami Tathagatanandaji. Well, Swamiji and his devotion to his mother. So he went wandering. Ultimately, he met his guru, his Govindapada, and who was a disciple of Gaudapada, who wrote the famous Karika, this commentary on the Mandukya Upanishad. And his guru instructed him to expound Vedanta by writing commentaries on the Upanishads, Brahma Sutra, and Bhagavad Gita. So this was his life. He wandered, but somehow he found time, because he led a very short life, found time to do all of the philosophical writings, the commentaries, the treatises. And we have so many poems that he wrote. Of course, some people will say that it was other Shankaracharyas later. But anyhow, most of it must have been his. And the things that weren't his were written in the same spirit. So some people like to say, oh, he didn't write that, he never would have done it. But even if it was a later Shankaracharya, it was following exactly his tradition. Traveled from holy place to holy place and got his disciples and trained them up. And then we know started this very well-organized monastic tradition, the Dashanami tradition, 10 different monastic groups broken down into four different parts of India with headquarters in the four corners of India, Sringeri, Puri, Joshimath, Dwaraka. And each one has its own Mahavakya. We'll get to this later. We know about these Mahavakyas, these great statements from the Upanishads. Probably Shankaracharya chose them at that time, and each one of the mats would have its own, like that. We don't find any reference to these Mahavakyas before him. So probably that was from him also. So each one had its own Veda, its own Mahavakya, and this was the start of this whole tradition. Now, because in our order, Sri Ramakrishna took sannyasa from Totapuri. Puri is one of the orders that's connected with the Sringeri mutt. So we have some formal but loose association with it, that Sringeri mutt. So one of the challenges for Shankaracharya was to prove the special value of Vedanta over the Mimamsakas, who were highly ritualistic, over the more dualistic types, schools of Vedanta, Sankhya and others, and also what remained of Buddhism at the time. It was sort of on the descent at that time, but still. One story that we know very well, that Shankaracharya wanted to debate this Kumarila Bhatta. He was a very well-known figure at that time. He's really the one who deserves more credit for defeating the Buddhists. And what he did, he disguised himself as a Buddhist so he could go in and get all of their secrets. And because of that, he was able to defeat them. But then he felt that he had to do some penance because this wasn't a very honest thing to do. So when Shankaracharya went to see him, he was in the midst of burning himself to death. Yeah. He was sitting there, and there was a funeral pyre and some very slow, painful type of death because he hadn't been truthful that way. He'd done something devious. So he said, no, go to my disciple, Mandar Mishra. And then there's a whole story. Mandar Mishra, he had his wife who was the arbiter of the whole thing. She had a flower garland, and when one of the arguments wasn't good, it would start to wilt. And there's so many stories connected how They came up with this plan, we'll have to ask some things about the householder life, which Shankaracharya doesn't know, and how he had to take the body of a king, and a lot of nice stories about that. Ultimately, Shankaracharya, his wife, Mandan Mishra's wife, Ubhaya Bharati, had to agree, or because it wilted, that Shankaracharya won, and then this Mandan Mishra became one of Shankaracharya's chief disciples, this Sureshwara. And he had these four main disciples. They went to the four corners and founded the different four mutts that we have. Now, in the midst of all of this, he didn't forget his pledge to his mother. He visited her on her deathbed. He was there when she passed away. And he himself built the funeral pyre, performed the final rites, despite all the objections from even his own relatives, because it was so much against the orthodoxy. Then he retired to the Himalayas and passed away at the age of 32. Now, we don't know how reliable all of the history is, but we know he did so much in a very short period of time. If you go to Kedarnath temple, you'll see a little hut there that's supposed to be where he passed away. But if you go to Kanchipuram, they'll also say he died there. So we don't know exactly where, and they'll also claim that they're one of the four or fifth mutt, we can say something like that. Now, when we go to their teachings, what I wanted to emphasize especially is that despite the very intricate teachings about the nature of the world and Brahman and the self and personal and impersonal, all of that, that both stressed the essentials of spiritual life. And that means this great sincerity and devotion and dispassion and love and compassion, seeing God and others, all of these elements, these are the things that they really stressed. Both have been branded as pessimists. The Buddha, because he spoke about suffering so much. The world is full of suffering. This was part of his compassion. It wasn't that he wanted the people to think this world is full of suffering, I have to suffer my whole life. It was, this world is full of suffering, there's a way out of it. So he wanted people to first understand that. And then with Shankaracharya, this idea of Maya, this world is unreal, people also branded him as a very pessimistic type of philosophy. But he wanted people to be realistic about this world, not to see that this world won't fulfill all of our desires. There's nothing in this external world that really can satisfy us when that yearning is for something within and something deeper. So they both spoke really about the vanity of this world, the vanity of seeking pleasures in external, transitory, changing things, and that we shouldn't waste this very precious human birth in trivial things, that we should use it as it's meant to be used in this pursuit of truth and realization. The Dhammapada, as I mentioned before, is really one of the great spiritual treasures of the world, the most important work. Of course, there's a vast liturgy in the Buddhist tradition. This is like Gita, small, but very, very important work. And attributed to Buddha himself, these are supposed to be different statements that he himself made. There are 423 verses, the Dhammapada, the way of truth. And again, there's no dry philosophy in it. It's a very realistic look at the world and a realistic look of spiritual life. And here we find the main teaching of the Buddha, which we know as the Four Noble Truths. And the first one is suffering, that there's suffering in this world. We can't wish it away, that mental suffering, physical suffering, that there's no way to get around it. Birth is painful, that youth is painful, with all, we know, the teenage years and everything. We start getting older, painful, old age is painful, sickness is painful, so many different things are there that can cause, klesha, cause pain, all these pain-bearing things. Then lamentation, dejection, despair, these are all painful. Contact with anything unpleasant is painful. Not getting what we want is painful. So he has a whole list of all these painful things. Then we know there's suffering. If we want to get rid of it, we have to know how it starts. So the second great truth is that suffering has an origin. And what is it that creates suffering or sorrow? Desire. So this is tanha, one of the the great truths that we have in spiritual life, that desire creates sorrow, then clinging to pleasure. We finally get something that we like, we don't want to let go, we hold on to it. And finally, not seeking the truth. Not having a higher ideal or a higher goal in life ultimately will lead to sorrow for us. So now we know that there's suffering. We know that there's a beginning to it. If it has a beginning, it has to have an end. So this is where it goes from pessimistic to very optimistic. So the third noble truth, that suffering has an end. And what is this end? It's called nirvana. It's the complete extinguishing, nirvana, blowing out the candle, extinguishing desire, ego, selfishness, and attachment, and the perfect joy of illumination. Now, different schools will say that this extinguishing means that it's the end of everything. There's a nirvana, there's no going to a heaven, there's no merging in Brahman, there's nothing. It's the end. Others will look at it more in this light, that it's a complete end to our bondage, and that we become one with that ultimate reality. So we find in the Dhammapada, this emphasis is on examining the transitory nature of the world and the painful nature of life, a selfish type of life, an ego-centered type of life. Then, on the other hand, examining the eternal and joyful nature of life in the spirit. And then, of course, giving up the one and devoting our lives to the other. This life of spiritual striving, this life of compassion. This was one of the keynotes of Buddha's life. This life of compassion, serving all beings, a life based on love and wisdom, on goodness and selfishness. All of these things make life joyful. They counteract the painful elements of life. Then a life of self-control, restraining the restless mind, and a meditative life culminating in the joy of nirvana. So these are the main teachings that we find in the Dhammapada. Now, there's Bhajagovindam. For those of you who weren't here for that meditation retreat, there's a nice story behind it, which I told then. Shankaracharya was walking with his disciples along the bank of the Ganga in Benares, and they came across a very old man who was sitting there reciting some of these Panini Sutras. This is the one in particular, and over and over and over again, trying to memorize it. Very old man. So it's like if you saw somebody, an old man, sitting and saying, I before E, except after C, I before E, except after C, something like that. Just some nonsense, just grammar. It's nothing spiritual, nothing at all. So Shankaracharya, this, not to make fun of him or anything, but took pity on this old man. And wanted to really make him understand that, don't you see, death is around the corner. What are you doing? Why are you wasting your time? What would be gained by memorizing these Panini rules of grammar? How will that help you at that final moment? So he said, Bhajagovindam, worship the Lord, do some spiritual practice, something like that. So we have that the one refrain that's repeated each time, Bhajagovindam, 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 Murdhamate, O foolish one. You worship God. You spend your time in some spiritual pursuit. Samprapte sannahite kali. What happens at that very final moment? What will save you then? Nahi nahi rakshati. This dukrin karane, I before E after C, won't save you. It won't be any help at all. So give that up. Spend your final days with some type of spiritual practice. So it's a very beautiful hymn. I won't go through the whole thing. I'll just I'll read a couple in English translations of some of the verses. He says, O fool, give up your thirst to amass wealth. Devote your mind to thoughts of the real. Be content with what comes through actions already performed in the past. The life of a person is as uncertain as raindrops trembling on a lotus leaf. Know that the whole world remains a prey to disease, ego, and grief. Exactly the same as Buddha's teachings. So long as one is fit and able to support his family, see what affection all those around him show. But no one at home cares to even have a word with him when his body totters due to old age. We remember some of the stories that Sri Ramakrishna told, huh? That when the disciple told the guru, oh, everyone loves me at home so much, they'll do anything for me. And he said, well, let's see. And he gave him a pill that would make it look like he died. And then they went, and the guru came in disguise and said, well, what happened? They said, oh, this wonderful son has died. My husband has died. Oh, what can you do? And he said, I can give him a pill that will save his life. So they rejoiced. They're so happy. And then he said, but one of you will also have to take one, and it'll be the end of your life. So he said, you all love him so much, I'm sure one of you will do it. Right? One of you will do it. Then the mother thinks, ah, but what of my other children? What will happen to them if I'm not there? And then the wife thinks also, I have to look after the whole family and everything if I'm not there. One by one, so while they're all saying, no, 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 he comes to normal consciousness. And then he wakes up and they say that he wasn't really dead. And then the guru says, see, you said that everyone loves you so much. Now you know no one is your own but the Lord. So we have the horrible things to think about. There's an even worse one. The other one is even worse because he dies sitting in a position like this where they can't get the dead, but what looks like the dead body through the door. So they start to chop down the door. And his wife says, what are you doing? He's dead and gone. We're just going to burn him. I have no way to repair the door. Rather, you cut his legs off. Anyhow, just to bring a little renunciation to the mind. So we have that verse. So and another one from the same Bhajagovinda, where it says that no one will even touch this body once it's dead. They'll look at it as a very unclean thing. You touch it, you have to bathe, and you can't go into a temple for so long and do anything like that. The same body that people are so attached. So all meant to bring this dispassion to the mind. Now, I just want to very quickly say a few words about Sri Ramakrishna and what his attitude was towards both of them, the Buddha and Shankara. It's very interesting because he had this ability, which we don't find anywhere else that I know of, to harmonize, to get to the essence of things, to find the common ground, and to show that these apparent differences are very external. He had that ability to do it, and we see it both in the case of Shankaracharya and the case of Buddha. With Shankaracharya, it was not so much a conflict between Shankaracharya and Buddha, but between different ideas that we find in Vedanta, in the Upanishads itself. Because we end up with two different doctrines, really. The main teachings of Advaita Vedanta, according to Shankaracharya, are Brahma Satyam, this word, that Brahman is real. Brahma Satyam, Jagat Mithya. This visible universe is somehow unreal or false, illusion, doesn't reach that level of reality. And then Jiva is Brahma. Brahmaiva Napra is Brahman itself and nothing else, nothing but Brahman. Now, all the schools of Vedanta will agree that Brahman alone is the ultimate reality. Brahman alone is ultimately real, and all of the schools will agree that the individual soul has a connection with the Brahman. They'll either say it's one with the Brahman, nothing but Brahman, this is Advaita Vedanta, or at least like a wave on the ocean, some connection, or like a spark coming out of the fire, something like that. But this question of the nature of the world, of the universe, in the Upanishads, we have more emphasis on this idea that it's a projection from Brahman. And this idea that this universe is an illusion, swapnavat, mithya, we don't really find that very much. I was curious about this. There's a concordance on all the important terms in the Upanishads and Gita. So I was trying to see mithya, this idea of illusion, falseness of the universe. Do we find it in any of the early Upanishads? No. We don't find it. So the view was more sarvam kalvidam brahma, that everything we see is indeed Brahman, that Brahman has become this whole universe. Now, Sri Ramakrishna saw the value in looking upon this world as unreal, but did not see it as a final position. He has a very nice way of reconciling all of this. He very often spoke of the dreamlike nature of the world. He used to tell the story, we know, of the farmer who was a jnani. A son was born to him and his wife in their old age, a very wonderful son they loved so much, and suddenly he got sick, and before they know it, he died right away. When the farmer heard about it, he seemed to be a little indifferent, didn't show much emotion. The wife got very angry and said, "What kind of man are you? Such a wonderful son has been born to us in our old age. He dies, and you don't have a tear to shed." And he said, "No, what happened was last night I had a dream that I had seven sons. Each one was more talented than the next, and handsome, and wonderful, and kind, and good, and everything. Now I'm wondering, should I be mourning this one son who died today, or those seven sons who no longer exist now?" So Sri Ramakrishna says to the jnani, the waking state, dream state is just as real as the waking state. Or we can say waking state is just as unreal as the dream state. Now, Sri Ramakrishna would tell this story only when there was somebody there who liked it. He used to say, "Let me tell you something that will agree with your spiritual attitude," something like that. Otherwise, he used to say that, "I don't like to call this world a dream. Swapnavat." He'd say, "I don't, it's not my particular..." He never said it's wrong. He never said that that's false, because for him, everything was a point of view. Everything was just a path. You can follow that path. But it didn't suit his spiritual taste. His attitude was more, everything is the Divine Mother is manifesting herself this way. So he used to say, "I don't like to call this world a dream, something unreal." But he thought that this type of discrimination, vichara, sadasad vichara, where we discriminate between the real and the unreal, between the eternal and the changing, and we try to isolate the real nature of the self by saying this is different, this is changing, this is not the self, anything that I can perceive, anything that's an object can't be the subject. He said this has a very great value, that this helps us break our false sense of identity with all these external coverings, with all the fleeting objects of the senses, and also with the internal, with the mind and the intellect and with our own ego and all of that. So he would say that we need to follow the Shankaracharya method, the neti neti, going up the steps to get to the roof, going up the ladder. Once we get there, from there we can see, when we start to come down, everything indeed is that same Brahman. So he had this very beautiful way of reconciling this. So when he was asked, "Is the world unreal?" he gave this very, very curious answer. At first sight curious, but when we know what he meant, is a very brilliant answer. He said, "Yes, this world is unreal until we have this realization of God. Then we know it to be real." That meant that our understanding of this world is erroneous right now, when we think of it as something external and something real and substantial and something of great value. Once we know what it really is, then we can say it's real, because we know it's nothing but Brahman. So he gave kind of the opposite answer, but it's really not in contradiction that way. So this is how he reconciled that. In the case of Buddha, the question was always, is there some way that when Buddha talks about the void, the shunya, shunyavada, it's called, this is Buddhism, is it somehow contradicting this idea that everything is purna, this Brahman is infinite, is full and perfect? Or is it somehow trying to say the same thing in a different way? When one says that Brahman exists and the other says that it doesn't exist, when he won't say that God exists or the self exists, he'll simply remain quiet. How do we understand all of these things? And does it really contradict some of the teachings of Vedanta? We have a very nice chapter at the end of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna during the time of Kashipur, when Thakur was in Kashipur, and Swamiji and some others had gone to Bodh Gaya for a short trip and came back. So the conversation was turning, of course, on Buddha and what the teachings were. And it's very interesting that Sri Ramakrishna knows almost nothing about it, because and it shows how little known Buddhism was to someone who came from a village there, and even all the pundits and everything, very few people spoke about it. It wasn't considered a very important philosophical doctrine or anything at that time. So he knows very little. He's asking questions about it, to Narendra especially. And whether Buddha's silence with regard to the existence of the self and the existence of God, whether that represented a kind of atheism, he knew at least that much, that this, Buddhism was called a Nastika philosophy. Atheistic. Actually, it's called Nastika because it doesn't accept the Vedas. But anyhow, it was taken to be atheistic. So he said a very beautiful thing. He said, why should Buddha be called an atheist? When one realizes Swarupa, when one realizes the real nature of oneself, the real nature of reality, the real nature of Brahman, one attains a state that is somehow between asti and nasti. So we can't even say it is not. We can't say it's full. We can't say it's empty. That it's beyond mind and speech. It goes beyond all of that. And the fact that Buddha remained silent is a good indication that he understood that, that it transcends mind and speech. So on these two very important points, Buddha and Sri Ramakrishna were really in perfect agreement. One is what the nature of reality is cannot be expressed in words. Buddha literally followed that because he remained silent. And Sri Ramakrishna followed it because he would say that Mukhe Bala Jayana, he said it over and over again, what Brahman is cannot be expressed by the tongue. We can't put it into words. And the second thing that Thakur agreed with Buddha on, of course, was that the goal of life is to have the direct realization of truth. So we see this nirvana, Buddhism, and the self-realization of Vedanta are one and the same. The descriptions are different. We don't know what that experience is like until we have it. It may be something that even after we have it, we won't be able to explain. And this is why later interpretations make it look different. But Sri Ramakrishna says that highest state of realization, there's only oneness there. So just as Buddha said, we're like someone who's been shot with an arrow. Instead of trying to pull out the arrow, we're asking who shot the arrow, what village did he come from, what was his caste, what tribe, what was his name, all of these different questions. He said, what will happen? You'll die before you get all of the answers. So pull out the arrow, that we're suffering now, and this suffering can be removed through this nirvana, that this is what we should be striving for. Just as Sri Ramakrishna said, you've come to the mango grove to eat the mangoes. Don't waste all of your time counting the number of twigs and leaves and branches and everything. Eat the mangoes to your heart content and make your life joyful. So this is some of the main spiritual teachings that we have of Buddha and Shankara. There's a distinction they make between vada and upadesha. This vada is argumentation. Buddha, Shankaracharya, he had to defeat others. He had to come up with his own philosophical system. But this upadesha, instructions about spiritual life, there we see perfect agreement with all of them, that we have to turn within, we have to remove this strong sense of attachment to the world, we have to have that great desire for realization, and we have to do our spiritual practice.